back to Germany. Now, this is Professor Shulgin, and...
Shulgin also says that he, as well as many others, feel that Germany is not fit to take a leadership role in the international deliberative process at this point. And I quote, that Germans are not prepared for this situation is evident. The current debate over the status of existing German commitments internationally reveals considerable anxiety at facing realities, as well as a dangerous shortage of political direction.
And how does that read in German?
Please, let's not do that tonight.
All righty, we'll not do
the
that.
The name of the book is Angst vor der Macht, Die Deutschen und ihre Außenpolitik, that is, Fear of Power, Germans and Their Foreign Policy. It just appeared in the Ullstein Verlag, Ullstein Publishing Company, about a month ago.
Oh, okay, so it's 1993.
Yes, it is.
Now, you were talking about the role of nationalism and expansionism in order to, basically, that the people lower down on the economic ladder in Germany who are now hurting, basically will, to borrow a phrase from Marie Antoinette, will basically let them eat fascism, or let them eat nationalism, or let them eat expansionism.
Let them eat caca.
Yeah, well, they'll usually the two go hand in hand sooner or later, but... This brings to mind another article that you mentioned to me in an off-air discussion, and that was an article by Professor Dieter Brock in the Süddeutsche Zeitung about German society as being two-tiered, and it seems to me that this would dovetail directly with that. Could you cite the source and go into Brock's discussion?
It is. First of all, the source is Dittmar, not Dieter, but Dittmar.
Oh, excuse me.
D-I-T-M-A-R, Dittmar, Brock, B-R-O-C-K. It was Privatdozent für Soziologie an der Universität Frankfurt. That is a professor for sociology at the University of Frankfurt. He is the article in the 14 March issue of the Süddeutsche Zeitung is Rückkehr der Klassen, the return of the class system. His point is that for the last 10 years, and with no hope of change, Germany has had a relatively stable pedestal of unemployment. They lie about the statistics because they do not include people who are in retraining programs or who are unretrainable and therefore are simply on welfare and therefore are out of the loop, so to speak. They are out of the window for unemployment statistics.
Which is interesting because the Reagan administration, excuse me for interrupting, Billy, but the Reagan administration and Bush administration have done something very similar with the way American unemployment figures are skewed. If you're working 1 hour a week and you can't get too far on 1 hour a week salary, no matter what you make, you're classified as employed, and they've been able to very successfully deceive with regard to the actual unemployment figures in this country. Go ahead.
Perhaps you are seeing the intellectual community of shared ideals that leads to the similarities between the two countries maneuvering. And this is something that I'm sure that you will investigate in the coming months.
Indeed, it was one of the central themes of many of my programs, including the aforementioned Radio Free America 37. Yes, I've gone into that at great length, and again, I will reiterate one of the central points of Radio Free America 37, which was that beyond the implications of the U.S. having lost the Second World War for the rest of the world, our political system, in which political assassination has now become commonplace, and in which that sort of subterfuge, which we saw in Germany, has now been put into effect in the United States, that in considerable measure, the German and fascist political system has conquered our own rather than the other way around.
It has. It makes it much more difficult for those of us who are interested in civil liberties at all to keep our act together. Let me give you another example on that. We were talking about the unemployment situation in Germany, so that the real unemployment is probably between 10 and 12% in the West and up to 30-35% in the eastern part of the country. That was the former German Democratic Republic, the former Marxist regime. Now, add to that as a footnote that before the wall came down, in eastern Germany there were 400,000 women serving as top managers in respective combines and concerns and companies and so forth in industry. Now, of those 400,000, less than 60,000 are now employed in any capacity whatsoever because the fascist mind seems to think that, well, when there are jobs are few and scarce and not many jobs to go around, then men should have them and women don't need them. And that is not the way that their society was. And now they are second-class citizens, and to be a woman in the modern Eastern Germany is pure hell indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who is taking up for their rights? Because it's difficult to find any group of people who is willing to take the risk of being slandered and defamed in public forums and in public media and press in order to go to Eastern Germany and say, look at the horrendous hypocrisy of this regime that is taking rights from women left, right, and center, is now taking the daycare centers from them, is taking their health care from them, is taking their choice of pregnancy termination from them, is taking all of these things away from them, and what has it given them? Absolutely nothing.
Rather, and again, not to belabor a point, but we have also seen under the Reagan and Bush administrations policies reminiscent of that put into effect in the United States. And
once again, great minds think alike, I guess. I don't know. But the point is here is that it is a two-tier Germany is in the offing.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the residual unemployment in the West.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the restructuring of industrial post-industrial society that is less emphasis on older heavy industry.
Mm-hmm.
And number three, the Eastern problems that they have not a rat's arse of an idea how to solve, nor do they intend to do so in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And then number four, that they have determined that there is what they deem an Expertenschwelle. This is where we come back to Professor Brock's thesis, that an Expertenschwelle, a schwelle is a threshold. I find trouble pronouncing this word in the best of times, but then a threshold of expertise. Above that, one is either educated or technologically skilled, and therefore will not have anything to fear. You will be warm and dry, and the state will take care of you. Beneath that level, and you will be so marginalized that you will no longer be permitted to participate in the upward mobility offered by any materialist culture.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore you are a second-class member. If you fall beneath that certain level of technological skill and education, this is not the tenet of an egalitarian philosophy.
In other words, we're talking about a permanent underclass.
We are speaking of a very permanent underclass and a permanently growing underclass, and you've got to do something with them.
And
as Sparta did, as Prussia did, now modern Germany will too.
And it's interesting, too, again, we have seen something very similar in the United States. There's been a fair amount of sociological writing about the creation of a permanent underclass here in the United States. And now, one of the things that Professor Brock has discussed is how, again,
what are they going to do with them?
Precisely. Go ahead.
Right. So his thesis goes a step further and tells us that this underclass will not have any hope, any prospects for climbing up out of the class and getting into a higher one. He compares this somewhat with Dickensian England and then says that even Dickensian England, the people had something to fall back upon. First, their class identity. We are laboring, working class people. And they had their working class clubs. They had their military careers to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
They had such things. And this kept them happy, relatively satisfied, at least enough combination of satisfaction and deference and fear that they did not suffer revolution. This is what Germany looks forward to also. These people are very useful. If you have you have intellectual ants and worker ants all in the same hive.
Mm-hmm.
Or anthill, excuse me, bees are in a hive, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
So you have lower class citizens who are denied equal access to upward mobility, measured in terms of material consumption, consumerism, and therefore they will be offered such things as patriotism to make up for this.
Mm-hmm.
Giant Fackelzüge, torchlight parades, enormous public benefits, with flag waving, with a lot of polemics, platitudes, a lot of rhetoric, a lot of haranguing the crowds, a lot of membership in something they all share together, the superiority and the beauty of being German together.
In other words, they can be all they could be all they can be.
That no matter how bad off you are as a German, they're still better than whatever is in second place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, these plans are already there. All we are talking about is the plans that have been there for years and years and are now coming to fruition, and the plans are getting implemented step by step by step.
What's interesting...
It's like the book Fatherland. Robert Harris wrote the book Fatherland.
Mm-hmm.
That was on the bestseller list many, many weeks in the United States, about a Germany that in which the Nazis won.
Mm-hmm.
And what would it look like today? And the Germany that won the war in the book, Fatherland,
mm-hmm.
is chillingly similar to the Germany of today. And they do the same things with their second-class citizens, with their foreign aid, with foreign minorities in their midst, or foreign nations around them. And it's chillingly similar to the actual truth of today. They also are dominant in a group that is remarkably similar to the European community. Now, this book was not was translated into German, and no German publisher would touch it.
Mm-hmm.
It was many weeks, 20, 30 weeks, I believe. I was not here for the entire time, on the American bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
They could not find 29 German publishing firms turned it down, one after the other, saying, well, we think that it is such a shallow treatment of the truth, and we're afraid it's a bad influence on young people. This is a theme we don't care to discuss anymore in Germany. That's past. Such things. So they found a Swiss publishing firm, and I forget the name of it, but it's selling very well throughout Europe now.
I imagine it is. It reminds me of a joke, an American joke. It's a good thing we didn't lose the Second World War. Otherwise, all our officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, and everybody would be driving Japanese and German cars.
That's true, and don't forget Kleindienst.
Yep, indeed, and a few
others. There's nothing wrong with your names.
No, of course.
I can't help that. We all have names from someplace, which reminds me, too, that perhaps 40 million Americans are part German. You know that the German law is law of the blood, jus sanguinis, to determine citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And for the earlier, the now retired foreign minister, Genscher, was once confronted with this. You were talking about, Herr Genscher, you, Sie reden ständig, you are constantly talking about the German minority in Russia and in Poland and places, the Volksdeutsche, the ethnic Germans in foreign countries. Well, why don't you include the 40 million or so Americans who are in this? Because if they can prove that a grandmother or a great-grandfather or something came from near Hamburg or Munich or Berlin, well, then shouldn't they have German passports also? And he was horrified at the very prospect. First of all, unfortunately, practically all Americans have debased their blood one way or another. They have intermingled with other peoples, and so therefore they would not be the most desirable of we patriots under this fascist scheme.
Fascinating. It is worth noting one of the smaller items in one of your papers. You talk about an organization in Anaheim in Southern California called the Phoenix Club, where apparently they speak German and celebrate not only Oktoberfest but Hitler's birthday. Which that's the first time I'd ever heard of that organization. So it's worth perhaps noting as a minor aside under the circumstances.
It's very strange because in Europe it's well known. I don't know how well known the organization is here, but everyone in Europe knows about it.
Well, it's funny. As a lifelong American political researcher, I'd never heard of it. Perhaps there are holes in all of our spheres of awareness, but it's an interesting situation. Going back to the two-tiered Germany and the let-em-eat-nationalism or let-em-eat-fascism policy that Professor Brock has talked about, in another of our off-air conversations, you were talking about Rhineland heavy industry and the pride that workers there took in the German capabilities or the capabilities of German heavy industry to expand in with regard to military production.
No, that is to retool and to change their production methods to accommodate for military production at a moment's notice.
Do you feel that perhaps in the event that the economic situation becomes worse, do you think that represents a possible partial solution to German economic problems?
I feel that it has been a partial solution in everyone's economy. If you have ailing industries, try to put them on to suck the teat of military.
Mm-hmm. And
is there anything new about this idea?
Well, no, obviously it's not new, and once again, perhaps the risk of seeming a little monotonous, take a look at the Reagan and Bush administrations and the enormous military expansion here, which helped to fuel the largely illusory boom of the 1980s. Speaking of German heavy industrial policy, one of the interesting aspects of German corporate policy that we've discussed, and I'd like to develop further here, it concerns the prohibition of dominant foreign ownership in any German corporation. At the same time, the German corporations are acquiring domination in foreign corporate interests, including and especially American.
Well, yes, there's a German word for this. It's called Einbahnstraße. That's a one-way street in English. We can own you, but you don't get to own us. Is that clear?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Can you discuss that a little more? Because among the interests that are increasingly the focus of German capital are American publishers. Also, it's interesting to note German capital vis-a-vis American intellectual production in universities. Could you discuss that that somewhat?
German capital in American universities, we have discussed, I think. My point in this was that if we have secretive foreign policies, and we have secretive banking, and we have secretive corporate accounting disclosure, so that the law does not require German companies to disclose their profit and loss with such detail as other countries do. It prevents there from being a meaningful meaningful stock exchange. There is no meaningful German stock exchange. Any German economist admits this. There is the economic life of Germany is not traded in shares of stock in Frankfurt. Most of the shares of stock of the huge industrial complexes and cartels in Germany are held by each other, i.e., 24% or a Sperrminorität or a blocking minority of shares in Messerschmitt, MBB, would be owned by Daimler, and vice versa. And then Deutsche Bank will own a blocking minority, or Dresdner Bank, or Commerzbank. And so between the bankers and the companies, they are like the seven sisters. They are all bought into each other and thoroughly integrated into each other.
The seven sisters.
Otherwise, include a few large insurance companies, which serve as institutional investors, long-range investors. This means that perhaps five shares of stock per year are actually exchanged. It's a meaningless routine, and it's only to present to the world the image that the large German industry is in the hands of private investors. They are no more private than they would be under a Soviet Komsomol type of system in which one combinat owns part of another.
Once again...
So it is a meaningless charade. And only the smaller German firms actually get traded meaningfully on any kind of exchange. But even there, private ownership doesn't change so much. There is not the mobility of ownership of investment as there is in the rest of the Western world.
And it's interesting because that also, again, is directly reminiscent of, and actually an extension of, what Hitler referred to as National Socialism, in terms of economic organization, as I understand it.
It is. Earlier, we had referred to a book by a gentleman, a professor, by the name of Simon Reich. His name is like the fellow in Clinton's cabinet, R-E-I-C-H. He wrote a book in 1991 called The Fruits of Fascism. Perhaps we should speak with him. The Fruits of Fascism, Post-War Prosperity in Historical Perspective. Was published by Cornell University Press, New York and London, in 1991. One of his basic theses here was that the corporatist approach to German industry predates IG Farben and predates the Third Reich, but it was never dismantled, and it is very much alive and well today, thank you, and kicking. So these interactive processes maintain both the ideology and the institutions, and the Bonn state, the Bonn government, of Bonn, Germany, retains the structural elements initially introduced under fascism. Unlike the major multinational companies, here is a good explanatory sentence that Mr. Reich says, that unlike the major multinational companies which developed out of the United States, Britain, Sweden, France, and Switzerland, from the early 1970s to the present, the German core companies, C-O-R-E, core, those who are at the core of the corporate cartel stranglehold system, which have their roots and identities either in pre-World War II firms or otherwise comprised part of the industrial cartels of the Third Reich, have not at all developed along the same lines. The German champion companies are indeed international, but not multinational. They remain steadfastly German in management, in personnel, in corporate technique, decision-making, and identity. That is also from Simon Reich's book of Fruits of Fascism. And this is, as a result, there is a parochial, corporatist, dirigistic feature of German industry that is not seen elsewhere in the Western world. The German companies are not multi-ethnic. The difference, and here I would refer your readers to Michael Porter's book, The International Competitive Position of Nations. And it's a very well-known landmark economic work.
Okay.
In which it refers to the difference between corporations which are steadfastly maintained as a national treasure for nationalistic purposes, and those which are multinational companies. In a multinational company, such as IBM, their director of operations in France is French. The director of operations in Germany is naturally German. And so it goes along. The same applies to a Dutch multinational such as Philips, Gloeilampenfabriek. Everybody knows the Philips company. And people who work for them, whether they are on an assembly line or all the way up to a top management position, realize that you don't have to be Dutch to be big in that company. Some are Dutch, most are not. In a German company, anything above middle management in any of their subsidiary corporations, in subsidiary countries, is always German. Always.
Really?
Their excuse for this is that, well, foreigners don't learn the German language very well, and that their management techniques are different, very much like the Japanese excluding American ski equipment from the markets because their snow is different. Remember that one?
No, that one's, I don't recall, but it...
No, they did that last year. That was just a market ploy. But
That sounds to me like a snow
political
job.
Corporatism. And this is what the German corporations do. They exclude others, which is why Eastern Europeans are scared stiff now that they will be left alone with no one but Germans to invest in them, because then they will have nothing but Germans telling them what to do in their own industry.
So basically the German corporations have been giving us, borrowing on that Japanese ploy, a snow job. or perhaps something which rhymes with that I can't talk about on the air.
I believe so.
Okay.
I believe you obviously have it. So, both felonious and fallacious.
Yep, okay.
The problem with the same thing happened when Volkswagen made a plant someplace, I forget where it was, at Ohio or Pennsylvania in the United States. And they appointed a chairman of the board for the American subsidiary here. And they had three or four of them who resigned because they would make decisions, and then someone would come in from Wolfsburg, Germany, on a plane and say thank you, and then they'd go back to Wolfsburg and make the real decision behind closed doors. And so these fellows felt like, well, they're the top American management personnel, but they are also a figurehead. They are doing nothing but sitting there in a nice office, getting plenty of money, and the actual decision-making is being done in Germany. And they got into this, and mark my words, the BMW plant that's going to go to South Carolina will be along the same lines, because they cannot do it any differently. They are so thoroughly convinced that no one but a German can understand any German product, how to make it, how to make money from it, and also they feel it is a great amount of loyalty.
Interesting. And indeed, we're getting into some puns. We will indeed mark your words, because it sounds like that's what's going to be going on. In,
well, what good are we if we can't make stupid predictions?
Yep. Well, I always refer, of course, to the Deutsche Mark as that pun. But going back now to German corporate policy and German fiscal policy, one of the most fascinating items in your paper, or papers, concerns one of the proposed changes in the German Constitution, namely one which would permit a vast broadening of surveillance powers. Part of the justification is that for that, ironically enough, and perhaps Machiavellian enough, is the need to suppress the skinheads, the neo-Nazis, much as the failure of police intelligence, or alleged failure of police intelligence, in the Los Angeles rioting of 1992 was used to drastically beef up police intelligence. It's an interesting situation, and another of the rationalizations for this broader surveillance proposal, which would permit the Germans greater German intelligence and police greater snooping powers, is to supposedly track the enormous amount of drug money currently in German banks. How about the German financial institutions and the drug money? Could you develop that for us?
I'm happy you asked that, because this is one of the sore spots that even what little dissidence is left in Germany that has not been bought or intimidated is now awakening to that very theme that you have just brought up. And so it is a very important thing to Germans in that the last vestige of privacy in Germany, you know, the government for some years has wanted Glazen der Bürger, that is, transparent citizenry, on the premise that if you have nothing to hide, then you should not be afraid of the police and all that sort of thing. It's the same as it was in an earlier time, 40, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the last vestiges was that it took a very high threshold of concrete evidence to convince a magistrate to give out a warrant in Americanese to listen to or to do electronic eavesdropping or surveillance. Because otherwise it was a violation of a citizen's privacy deeply anchored in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
That was about the last one, because otherwise all the laws concerning what you can say in public and what you cannot say have been so diluted that there's very little you can say without taking a great risk upon yourself, civilly or criminal liability. And speaking out in public and getting one's name known for being a dissident, if you are not a paid puppet dissident that is paid by either the Goethe Institute, for example, or some other government foundation as a tame house court jester to make jokes about the king, you know? The
mm-hmm.
court jester is permitted to do this, but if the citizen on the street makes the same joke about the king, he is beheaded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the sort of situation it's running into, so that you see two or three main dissidents, main irritants, resident irritants, being paid to poke fun at the establishment in any given city.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, there's not very much room for them. And then the Germans can always point to this and say, even in the Goethe Institute, but we have a culture and we have a counterculture. Look at the people that are saying nasty things about the government.
Mm.
Yes, here is one, there is two, and they are paid by the state to do this.
Fascinating.
It's clever.
And it also...
For the average citizen to do this,
mm-hmm.
it means that you are classified as politisch unzuverlässig. That means that you are politically unreliable. You probably have just put a cap on your career right there.
I'll tell you something else that's very interesting. Again, there is a very strong and ominous parallel with what has happened here in the United States. One of the major focal points of CIA activity in the immediate post-World War II period was the creation of a non-communist left, because they sought to woo the American left away from its then affiliation with Moscow. And the results of that program were so successful that by the late 1950s, and this will sound ludicrous to the uninitiated observer, but by the late 1950s, the CIA control of the quote left unquote, and that's one of the reasons I always put it in quotes, was so great that the FBI literally considered the CIA to be a communist organization, because every time J. Edgar Hoover's boys began to snoop into the quote left unquote, meaning what they considered to be communist, namely anything that was in any way left of center, they came across the CIA. And something very similar to that holds sway in the United States, where we have, and now this is not to say that every progressive
but if I could interrupt
person.
Just 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Many years ago, I won a scholarship out of Germany, and I studied for a semester in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And that was political science. And many of the people who were involved in, National Student Association or National Student Congress or one of those things,
mm-hmm.
that sounds a lot more Marxistic than it actually was. But they were also one day they woke up to be very disappointed to find out they had been paid by the CIA the entire time,
mm-hmm.
that they had been getting money from them, and they had been getting moral support, and they had been getting logistical support and information and so forth, and they found out that they had been paid plants by the CIA, and of course this was a dismal disgrace and a loss of faith and a humiliation for them.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very sorry for these people having been manipulated like that.
Yeah, but the
I'm sure something comparable happened business today.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the reasons why, even though we have the appearance of alternative politics, and to a certain extent it's more than appearance, yet there are certain subjects, the aforementioned assassination of President Kennedy is one of them, where you will find the so-called progressive political forces lining up as one with not only the mainstream press, but the forces of reaction. And this is a chilling legacy of the immediate post-World War II CIA policy, and one which, as we've seen, has an ominous parallel in the fascistic policies that are being pursued now in Germany. Speaking of going back for
could we, however, we were talking about civil liberties,
right,
and protection of privacy, and the Lauschangriff, that is the electronic surveillance and other such things,
mm-hmm.
warrantless intrusions into privacy.
Right.
I think the best way for me to treat this is to simply read you two sentences that I wrote. Whoever fails to understand civil liberties and minority rights and their essential nature in any true democracy will sooner or later permit their abridgment or curtailment. The SPD, that's the Social Democrats opposition, recently gave its consent to the increased and warrantless electronic surveillance of private homes in Germany. This is Lauschangriff and the name of the law in Germany that they are changing, which may require some constitutional dickering, is the Abhörgesetz, A-B-H-O umlaut R-G-E-S-E-T-Z,
mm-hmm.
Abhörgesetz. Ostensibly to combat the mafia and the international drug trade, as well as people who trade in coyotes who bring in unlawful illegal immigrants.
Hmm.
In so doing, the major German parties ignored a salient fact that the best source of evidence in drug trafficking prevention is in the money laundering network, as the FBI and Swiss authorities often testify. Yet there is not one word spoken in the Bundestag about lifting German banking secrecy to reveal money laundering channels, despite new evidence that of over $300 billion in drug money currently circulating in the world banking system, some $60 billion resides in Frankfurt, German banks. This is from the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, a very well-respected Zurich, Switzerland daily paper, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, of December 23rd, 92.
So this broadened surveillance, this warrantless intrusion, is being rationalized in order to combat the enormous amount of drug money in German banks, and yet a German banking secrecy law, which most Americans, including myself, were not aware of, has not been lifted, which, of course, that would appear to be, if that was the source of the irritation, that would be the most effective way of eliminating it.
It shows the hypocrisy of the program.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to get drug, if they wanted evidence to wipe out the drug trafficking and the mafia and illegal arms exports and the coyotes who are making money from bringing in illegal immigrants, if they wanted to wipe out these networks, they could do so by monitoring the bank's transfers.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, also, because they don't do that, and because the German banks are very secretive, both in their accounting practices and in the what they do with the money, it was very difficult for the American FBI to find out why there were money transfers coming out of Germany to the people who blew up the World Trade Tower.
Mm-hmm.
The German connections with this and with other such terrorist activities should not be overlooked, and I would suggest that you continue, and you and your associates continue the research. I think that you are going to find more rather than less unravel itself as time goes on that,
mm-hmm.
and it may help us gain some insight as to why Lufthansa planes are never terrorized.
And indeed, we not only see the tracks of the World Trade Center bombing going back to Germany, but Pan Am 103, in which the real culprits, aside from the official okey-doke, appear to be BND, Galen, a World Anti-Communist League-connected elements of our own intelligence system. And indeed, the insurance investigators report for Pan Am, which has been hotly disputed in this country, it basically named a fellow named Manzer al-Kassar, a Syrian national who has worked in the Iran-Contra affair with Oliver North, among others, and who used a firm, Merex, a West German arms firm, which has served as a BND front in the past for some of those deals. And, of course, that was in Frankfurt, where that plane was apparently bombed.
True.
Where the bomb was put on board.
At the same time that Austrian Minister Kinkel, Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel, has been making overtures to various Islamic governments to promise them a good deal of cooperation in getting them onto the UN Security Council permanent seats if they support Germany in the first round.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, speaking of the perpetuation of the Third Reich, there were very significant Third Reich intelligence networks and operational networks into the Islamic world. Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj Amin al-Husseini, actually having been an SS officer, the first leader of the Palestinians, the first national leader of Palestinians, Palestinian nationalism after the creation of Israel, and in fact had a background in the SS, and continued to work with what have become known as the third position fascists in the post-World War II period. And these networks have apparently not only been preserved, but the CIA inherited at least the Galen-linked elements of the CIA and other intelligence, U.S. intelligence, have inherited some of those connections in the post-World War II period under the auspices of not only the Galen Organization, but Otto Skorzeny of Odessa fame. And that's also something that I've gone into at great length mm-hmm. in past programs. One thing I'd like to get your opinion on, Billy, there has been, since the elimination, since the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Iron Curtain, and with the loosening of border restrictions vis-a-vis the creation of the EC, there has been a widely reported drastic upswing in European drug traffic. This is just a question that occurred to me. Is it possible, are you in a position to comment whether or not perhaps the enormous amount of drug money in German banks and that upswing in drug traffic are not only connected, but that perhaps, at least to a certain extent, the Germans, and particularly looking to German intelligence, might be involved with some of that as a means of acquiring badly needed capital?
Number one, funny you should say that. I think the two things I would have to say about it are as follows. If not their intelligence branch, then at least their propagandistic branch was heavily at work prior to this, because prior to the Germans were though in the forefront of placing heavy pressure on the Swiss to lift the banking secrecy, to get rid of the mafia drug money and so forth, because the Germans were complaining that the Swiss were at fault for allowing all the drug money laundering.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the Swiss agreed, all right, we'll stop it and we'll cooperate with the Americans, with Interpol, with anyone you want to send, mm-hmm. the Swiss did this and they proved themselves to be very good citizens. And so the money had to go someplace. We went to Germany. And one wonders, there is an old saying that is very short and in two words, in total of seven letters in Latin. And it is cui bono.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the benefit flow?
Mm-hmm.
Who stands to profit? So therefore, when they were screaming that the Swiss are thieves, catch that thief, fasten deep, and they are doing the same thing now, except they have made big money out of it. I think that once again, we can't judge, we can't sit inside as a fly on the wall in a meeting of the Bay and Day. I wish we could.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice. That would clear up a lot of things. They would simply have to hold the meetings elsewhere, wouldn't they? But for the time being, all we can do is judge what their propaganda says, point out the Heuchelei, the hypocrisy of it, and to bring these things out in the open to say, don't judge them by what they say they are doing,
mm-hmm.
judge them by what they actually do. And when they refuse to cancel their banking secrecy, when they refuse to supply any evidence, and then when others painstakingly put together this picture over a period of years, and by that time they have changed the situation and moved on to something else. It makes it very difficult because it is veiled in secrecy.
Something that's interesting, too, I know I have a colleague who translates articles from the Italian press as well as other European papers, and there have been a number of German connections emerging vis-a-vis the Italian drug traffic, too. Some of that is being traced back to Germany, which would lend support to that hypothetical line of inquiry. Something that's interesting, too, another ominous parallel between what we're seeing in Germany with the warrantless intrusion being rationalized by the need to pursue the drug traffic money at the same time as the German banking secrecy laws are being preserved. Here in the United States, there has been an enormous erosion of civil liberties and broadened surveillance powers under the rationalization of fighting the war on drugs, which belongs in quotes, and at the same time, as it is a matter of public record, that U.S. intelligence agencies have been deeply involved with many of the drug cartels and have actually assisted them as a function of covert operations. So again, another ominous parallel.
One thing that fascistic organs and intelligence, secret espionage agencies are ipso facto typical parts and branches of the fascist tree, a very important part of the main trunk of it.
Mm-hmm.
These groups always find it easier to deal with their problems on a day-to-day basis if the citizenry is not so irritating. People are not giving them so much trouble. They also find it much easier to continue if they don't have to have these annoying, vexing such things as elections and other dirty words. So they can continue a stable development of power over the years. Fascism is its own reward. You have to understand the mentality of the people who do these things. It requires a certain combination of arrogance, of technological prowess, and a feeling of superiority and a total disregard and disdain for other people and whatever rights they might want. This is why Germany is not the sole fascistic nation in the world and never was.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And all we can do is say, look, students, here is a good model. Here is what not to do, and here is what has to be brought out into the open now, because hopefully there are still enough Germans left of goodwill and of democratic leanings that would not simply do the politically correct thing and hold up a match or a candle to say, hello, I love foreigners, but to actually do something meaningful and not a futile, senseless, empty gesture.
And again, I want to reiterate...
Did you understand also that the gentleman who arranged the most successful Fackelzüge and these demonstrations in Munich was not a German. He's a journalist who was of Italian family but born in Sweden. And so he sees things with the perspective of an outsider, which is typically European history, and that is the beauty of Europe, is that when it's working properly, they're all outsiders, and that's what makes them nice, because they can see each other through different eyes. And this is what keeps a balance and keeps some perspective to the European cultural historical situation. And this is absolutely needed. Any time a nation speaks in terms of linguistic hegemony, of cultural purity, of all of these things that run contrary to human rights generally, then we have the seeds and then the fruits of fascism.
Absolutely. And once again, I want to reiterate that people should not interpret this discussion as anti-German, but anti-fascist. And indeed, one of the things that I've been noting is the numerous and very significant and ominous parallels between what is going on in Germany and what is going on here in the U.S. of A. Billy, something that I have focused on at great length, perhaps to almost the frustration of certain listeners, and that is what is now known as the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the successor to the Galen Organization. The BND is the central element, the Galen Organization, the central element in my working hypothesis in Radio Free America 37, that it was a Trojan horse, and that in considerable measure, not only as a result of the BND, but as a result of its interaction with the very profound fascist elements in this country. Some of our industrialists and financiers, many of the most important, were openly pro-fascist. They liked the anti-communism and the anti-labor stance of fascism. And there were also people in our national security establishment, our military and intelligence services of a similar bent. But the BND, the Galen Organization...
It did not surprise anyone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Fascism, again, is not a German phenomenon, and it is unfortunately taking root and flourishing all too effectively here in the United States. But with regard to the BND, some of the things that I wanted to discuss here, we've touched on the connections between BND and the Goethe Institute. We've also touched on the lack of accountability of the BND to the Bundestag, to the German parliament, even more so than the CIA, which at least has nominal accountability. Note nominal, the use of the term nominal.
Well, I think, no, on the contrary, for an espionage organization, for an intelligence organization, I think that there are a lot more controls if the people in the White House and Congress wish to exercise those controls is the main problem. But they are there. They can call the people on the carpet anytime they please. They can cut off their money. They can demand accountings. They can make sure that organization is working for them and not the contrary.
They could, but unfortunately...
In Germany, they do not have that. In Germany, it is a part of the core of the central core of the dirigistic corporatist philosophy. When you speak about the various aspects of their activities, do not neglect that they are doing a lot of espionage on behalf of large German companies. They are doing commercial espionage. This is quite something, because they do not have either scruple or checks and balances or restraints upon their activities the way the American does, or most other Europeans, for that matter. And therefore, the calls now are rather strange in the United States. I suspect a virus here, and I would like to check this out with you and your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
We are now at a point of debate. There is a debate in the Freistaaten, in the United States, about the future role of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Should it be larger? Should it be smaller? Should they be doing environmental work? Should they be piling up sandbags at the levee? What should they be? Who should they be? How many should they be? How rich should they be?
Mm-hmm.
All these are healthy questions. It's a good house cleaning type of question. If we take the second step and say, well, there are going to be certain agreed upon, assigned, designated tasks, and you must keep within these boundaries. And then there should be less problem. There should be a very effective streamlined CIA. Now, the next thing. Should it be doing commercial espionage? That is, should it be doing counter-espionage? Should it come up with... there are B&A agents that have infiltrated a project that are taking, sapping your technology, either by computer hackers or by human on-the-ground people, out of a certain joint venture or a project that you have that is on the leading edge of technology, and the B&A is taking this and turning it over to German core companies, even as we speak.